You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting to Yes And.
Well, this was a lovely conversation. I shouldn't be surprised, but I didn't know Neil Malarkey. Neil is a highly accomplished, he's highly accomplished in the field of management training, having run many workshops and hosted conferences for private and public organizations. He uses improvisation. He's got an incredible career with the Comedy Store Players in London. He was partners in a comedy duo with Mike Myers. And he's got a terrific new book. It's called In the Moment, Build Your Confidence, Communication, and Creativity at Work. You're going to love this pod.
Unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Neil Malarkey, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So there was a line in the first chapter of your new book that actually surprised me. You write, quote, "I had never seen an improv show until I was in one," end quote. So I have my weird story of entering improv without knowing what it was. Yours, I think, is more dramatic because you were improvising and then figured out what improv is. So how did that happen?
Well, I met a man called Mike Myers. You might have come
across him. Yeah.
And so I was doing a show with the Cambridge Footlights, out of Cambridge University, people like Hugh Laurie, Stephen Fry, Olivia Colman, Emma Thompson, Peter Cook, and half of Monty Python, Sacha Baron Cohen, and some of those younger me, some are older, I won't say which. So he'd heard of Cambridge Footlights. He was living in the UK, in London. He'd arrived, having been kind of pretty successful in Toronto with Second City Touring Company, done some commercials, done much music with Chris Ward, who people might have heard of, Alana Miles. He was her producer and so forth, or you might not have done. So Mike arrived thinking, hey, I'm okay. I've done stuff in Toronto and around Canada. And then because he had a British passport, he could live here. Nobody had heard of Mike Myers. Nobody had heard of Second City.
Right.
So he was left wandering the streets, literally, and knocked on the door of this pub theatre, small theatre above a pub, and it said Cambridge Footlights. So he said to them, can I help? And they said, yeah, right, you paint the set. Okay. And you can sell tickets. So there he was. I met him. He was sitting in a wheelchair, not because he's a wheelchair user, but we'd use the regular chairs on set for a show called Get Your Coat, Dear, We're Leaving.
Okay.
Which we'd been hoping for a show to, you know, the title came before the show. It was just sketches, really. But we thought it'd be funny for us to be sitting on stage eating while the audience came in. Such a small theatre that they had to come past us. Of course, it set the tone of, we don't care what you think, audience, but there we go. So Mike was sitting there selling tickets, and he made me laugh. He's funny. He's funny. He knows funny. And I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm writing sketches. I said, this is 1985, by the way. I said, sketches, nobody wants sketches. Everybody wants stand-up. Stand-up, that's what they want. Really? I said, oh, I'll take you to see some of the burgeoning alternative comedy world. We did. He did that funny thing where he walks down the stairs, but actually on the level, so behind a car that you've seen perhaps since. He made me laugh. I said, let's do a sketch all about that. And so we did a double act called Malarkey and Myers with that sketch, which was basically us doing jokes and then trying to make a story around that joke of, you can only see the top half of somebody. It's called Dr. Wicked, if people want to look for it. It's on YouTube from the Edinburgh Festival in 1986.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a move afoot by some comedian, Kid Hollebach, who'd worked with Robin Williams and others in San Francisco, had done improv. And so let's do improv. Why don't we persuade the Comedy Store in London to open on a Sunday night, not just Friday, Saturday, and doing improv. And nobody knew what improv was, literally. Right. If you were kind of a theater type, you might heard improvisation to create characters and create stories. Yeah, yeah. Very serious, heavy improv. And so Kid asked Mike, do you want to come and join us? And I've never quite been sure. Did she say, bring that guy with you? He seems okay. Because they'd seen me working with Mike doing sketches. We did these sketches, which were basically, Mike describes it as stuff you do to make girls laugh in kitchens at parties. So silly visual stuff. And they, Mike said, okay, I'll bring him along. Whether Mike said, you know, bring him or can I bring him? Or they said, bring him. I don't know. Because not many people did improv. So literally Kid and Mike taught us improv. And then I was in a show. We had a tiny moment before that playing a small theater, another pub theater, doing alternative comedy, where we had this sketch. The Dr. Wicked sketch wasn't ready yet. So we did do a very short one, which was us going da 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 tequila, da 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 tequila. I don't know if you'll have to pay copyright for that, but
I won't.
The joke became, we'd say other letters, words beginning with T. And then eventually we had these jackets. Again, I bought these kind of dinner jackets. One was blue, one was green, tuxedos, in a charity shop, a costume in search of a sketch. So we wore them for this thing. And at some point we'd reveal the word tequila written inside the jacket, sort of duct taped inside. The audience was bemused, but that was our, so our 5 minute open spot was 2 minutes of tequila. And then 3 minutes, Mike said, let's improvise.
Okay.
So I don't know what we asked the audience for, but I was literally, my head was reeling. I nearly fell over. I didn't know what I was doing. Mike was being funny. And then that was a few months before we actually did it. We did it at the Edinburgh Festival with Kit Hollebach and Paul Merton and Dave Cohen, who then became the Comedy Store Players in October 1985. So I'd never seen an improv show before I was in one. And there's a huge gap in my improv knowledge. I have seen the Harold,
yes,
once at the Groundlings in LA, but most of what I've seen is short form.
Yes,
To my eternal shame, there are so many wonderful practitioners out there doing great stuff, but you know, I was in a show before I knew what I was doing, and that has kind of continued in some respects.
Yeah, I know. So similarly. You know, I was a dishwasher here at Second City when Mike was on stage in Chicago right before he got hired for Saturday Night Live. And when I started to work, I wanted to be a playwright. So I was working in theater, just getting any sort of job. And I did not know that Second City created its shows through improvisation. And I really wasn't aware of theatrical / comedic improvisation in the slightest. My thesis on Jack Kerouac and the Beats, and part of that was on spontaneous, what Kerouac called spontaneous bop prosody, improv writing. I was a Deadhead. I saw like 89 Grateful Dead shows. I love when they improvised. I was a jazz fan. I understood that sort of improvisation. And I think I played soccer, football, and again, very improvisational in terms of, you know, the game, especially if you're playing it right. Most people in the States were not at that point, but we would, you know, I'd go to soccer camp and they'd show us, you know, World Cup games. And so, you know, I was watching Franz Beckenbauer and Giorgio Canali and Pelé and all those. But you get exposed to it, right? And you're like, this is madness. This is magic. And then as you start to become more acquainted with what's going on, you're like, oh no, it's not that at all. And what I always talk about is the fact that it's very much a practice. And in your book, you talk about the fact early on of like, this isn't about winging it. And I think, unfortunately, we don't really have a good name for the thing we're actually talking about. We do call it improvisation, but I think you and I are talking about something different. And I have to say things like, it's not ad-libbing, it's not spontaneity. I sometimes will say wise improvisation, but you get what I mean. There's like the term improvisation does not really sum up what you and I are talking about when we talk about this application.
Exactly. And that's why I use the word improv.
Yeah.
I say improvisation is ad-libbing, making stuff up. Yep. Improv it is, yes, you're making it up. And there was a funny thing is I was giving a workshop at London Business School once, and I was 15 minutes into talking about improvisation, improv as a practice, etc. And this guy whose English was not his first language said, "Do you mean lying?"
Yeah.
No, I said, and I could see his logic was improv is making
not
it
wrong.
Up. Making it up is lying.
Yeah.
And I see, you know, who was it? François Truffaut said, you know, we're lying at 24 frames per second. Anyway, so I would say improv is a practice which has a lot in common with other improvised forms of art. Jazz being perhaps the easiest read across, but art as well, where there is structure, there is a praxis, there is, and I'm glad you've used so many long words already, prosody being one, that it's a praxis. So it's yes, we're making it up, but the apparent chaos is looking for emergent structure. We are trying to find structure within the chaos. We're not trying to make it messy and unformed. We're constantly creating form where we can. And for me, the greatest form is story. Mm-hmm. Along the way are funny moments, even occasionally a joke. But sometimes a joke spoils the story, but let's not be too purist. But so you're absolutely right. So I say improv is a thing. Which improvisation is a broader term, making it up as you go along. And I use the phrase winging it, because in the old days, the theater, the person who was winging was in the wings at the side of the stage, and they'd fail to learn their lines. There were lines. There was only one version of the script, and they'd fail to learn it. And they were in the wings. Well, what's my line? What's my line? And so they were in a non-creative state. They were trying to remember stuff of which there was only one version. Improv is we're open by saying we know nothing. We have only ourselves and you to create. There is no script. We are going to co-create that. And so very often people, when I say to business people, has anyone improvised? Yeah. For them, it's what you do when things go wrong. For me, improv is what you do to make things go right. Whatever ingredients you have. And that to me is the joy of improv, both as an interpersonal skill. I've never met you. I have a conversation with you. I do know you. We've worked together before, but let's still try and find a creative conversation. And improv as a mindset, kind of the world is changing. Things happen I didn't expect. How can I live in that world of uncertainty and ambiguity?
I want to find this quote for you. So I'm interviewing next week Zeynep Tone, who's a MIT professor who has a good jobs strategy. And part of her thesis is that employers don't really understand how crappy they pay. And they also don't understand not just the cost of the pay, but also time, not giving their people enough time. And it's fairly radical. I really admired it. And then, you know, we have a thriving business here at Second City where we teach, like you do, improvisation to business people. And this is the quote. I just pulled this out. This is like 20 minutes ago and sent it to the people who do the selling for our corporate group. She writes in the book, quote, "It's impossible to specify every interaction in advance. The more management tries to add standards, policies, rules for unpredictable situations, the more often their specifications and scripts are going to be useless, counterproductive, or infuriating in practice," end quote.
I have to defend the people she's attacking in a way.
Go for
it. Because we have to have some structure.
Yeah.
And I'm a big fan of ambiguity. In everything, the opposite is true. yin and yang. So many binary philosophical approaches. The shadow, Jung, which is every strength had its shadow. Courage, the shadow, i.e. the obverse, is recklessness. The strength of decisiveness means insensitivity. And that's where Myers-Briggs and Jung come in as well, which is if you're too far down the spectrum this way, you've forgotten what it is to be nearer the middle. And so that's why I would say, and that's kind of the thesis of my book. I've called it In the Moment, but I've had my cake and eat it by saying a moment could be 6 months. It could be a year. It could be a moment in history. It could be the moment when you realize who you are, that you shouldn't be doing that, or you should be doing more of this. So I like the words, you know, infuriating. So many structures are infuriating. But how do you have my friends at Ashridge Business School, now part of HALT, would talk about minimal structure, maximum autonomy. So just enough.
Lovely.
Mm-hmm. Just enough structure. And you and I know that improv actually is structure.
Lots of structure.
The yes and is structure. Yes, what you said is a value. I want to build on that.
Yeah.
That's a structure. It's a microstructure. It's possibly harder to look at and understand than a timetable and a calendar and an org chart. But I always say to people, look, I perform at the Comedy Store every Sunday doing improv. I know we're going to start at 7:30. I know we're going to finish at 9:30. I know the Comedy Store is taken care of, security, insurance, food, drink. There's plenty of structure within that so that we can improvise.
That's right.
So that when the audience is there, we are truly in the moment. But we know there's five other people. They've been booked in advance. We know the games we're going to play. We have a little running order. So there's kind of enough structure. We don't just turn up naked any time of the day or week. Whoever's there, just do it, man, which is a happening. And not to say that doesn't have its own joy. The question I ask people is, do you know what sort of situation you're in? Yeah. Are you in a structured moment that requires prep, organization? Are you in a free-form moment where you do need to listen and be able to notice what's happening and co-create out of the seeming chaos? And that's where I borrow a quote from Woodrow Wilson. I didn't know he was the only president of the United States with a PhD in political science, but he says people make the mistake of thinking that government is accountable to Newton rather than to Darwin. Now, I did high school maths and physics. Not everyone knows what I'm talking about. The other day I said, anyone know who Isaac Newton is? And somebody said, is he E equals MC squared?
Oh, no.
People say, oh, the guy with the apple. And I said, well, gravity is an example of a force, but he has three laws of motion, that things go at the same speed unless a force acts on them, etc. But basically, that gives rise to machines. Press this lever here, and out of the machine over there comes a sausage or whatever. And occasionally you will get moments like that in organizations. Woodrow Wilson said government. I say any organization is accountable to Darwin, adapting, evolving, not always adapting well, actually. Some maladaptation takes place. So there are moments when you want to be prepared and structured. So that's where your guest next week will have to sort of say, well, yeah, okay, I do get up at certain times. I do have an office and I do have bookshelves where things are where they should be. But don't turn up for a presentation and say, well, I haven't thought of anything, whatever. But right. Don't equally turn up for a coaching moment or a team or with a client where you say, let me stick to my script, say what I've got to say, and then I'll go away. There are moments which require one form or the other. And you and I know, Kelly, that those moments could live side by side. You need Second City does improv, but it has a sketch.
We also do sketch. Yeah.
It becomes a sketch. And, you know, you have to follow the fire regulations. Start on time. And this is another one I always say. Theatre is just about the only activity I know where we're on time and on budget. We don't say, unless it's a huge deal, I guess. But we normally say whatever happens the first night, tickets are sold. We've got to be there.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're going to start on time. We have to, and we got a budget. It's probably pretty small in theater. We got to stick to it. Most building projects, IT projects, business things go way over time, way over budget.
It's interesting because I'm often talking when I talk to business groups about some of the, in our work, we talk about, you know, making your partner look good, but also in the theater, we have a stage manager who comes by and says 10 minutes and you say back to that stage manager, thank you, 10. And it's literally, and when I had kids, like during bath time, when they didn't want to get out, I'd be like, we got 10 minutes, and they would have to say, thank you, 10. And it was a very useful tool to sort of signal to this child And I'm talking about my child, not the actor.
Yes.
But you can draw your own conclusions. that in 10 minutes, we're getting out. In 5 minutes, we're getting out. Okay, we're getting out. And that paved, that was just important. And again, that speaks to what you're talking about, which is incredible constraints that are levied to unleash creativity. So we know how big this stage is. The stage is a very particular size, and it's the same size every night. And we know we're going to start and finish at a certain time. And we know this, you know, at Second City, two acts of this show are primarily scripted. There might be some improv. That third act is yours. But there's a reason it's late at night. It's a reason the cast often changes into less formal wear, clothing, because we are doing all this context setting for what is going to become next. Because as you and I know, improvisation is incredibly tender. That unlike just showing up and doing a Shakespearean play or sonnet, which mostly people will understand what's going on, they would not. Most regular audiences would still, even as popular as improv has become, they would still not understand the thing they're seeing. I mean, my dad was a theater critic for years here in Chicago, and I produced a long-form improvisational show, huge, massive hit. He didn't understand it. He was literally I saw that people liked it. Congratulations. I don't understand what's
happening. How lovely. And we're all looking for our father's approval. How lovely that he failed singularly to approve that.
But
it's interesting that you talk about fragile. People say to me, what about if you're heckled? And I said, that's fine. As long as they say it clearly and loudly, we can all hear it. And it may be funny. That's fine. As you say, one of our ethos, elements of our ethos is make the other person look good. There comes a time when you need to say shut up. But as long as somebody says loud and clear, that's an offer. And this, of course, is our a currency, and everything is an offer.
Yep.
Is a title of a book by a friend of mine called Robert Poynton. Everything is an offer. Mm-hmm. An offer, something happened, somebody said something. Oh, how can I use that? But of course, the worst heckle isn't a heckle at all. It's those pre-Christmas office party shows.
Yeah.
Where somebody, it's not the question of somebody shouting out, you know, what about the chicken? Which is great because, oh, I'll be a chicken. I can use that. If it's just the hubbub, the group of people, 10 or more, who are just saying, oh, who wants a drink? You want wine, lager, beer? Okay. And that is when you realize how actually fragile what we're doing, because any slight distraction like that means we can't be in the moment. We're thinking, what are they saying? What should I stop and say, be quiet, please?
Mm-hmm.
I've it's kind of a Zen thing. It's kind of a state of relaxed concentration. And people will be surprised when I don't remember what we did that night, because I call it, I'm in flash, not in hard drive. And so if you can get to that state of flow, wouldn't it be great? Wouldn't it, if whatever our job is, we could do that with somebody. And of course, I love ensemble improv. People think it's a stand-up ad-libbing. And I always say, no, it's a type of theater where the fourth wall is there. We're creating scenes. We're looking for stories, but it is quite fragile. It's, as you say, the audience doesn't really know what they're seeing. We will occasionally step out and say, that was a block. You know, when somebody does something that we would consider, oh, that's denied my reality. But then, of course, the game becomes, can I deny her reality? And it's like playing basketball blindfold or something. You're deliberately sort of playing a different type of game, but underneath it, it's still yes and. It's still, I'm holding you safely here. Even if it looks like I'm teasing you, I know that if I tease you a little bit, the audience will think, oh, and then I know you can ascend to the heights. I'm still trying to make you look good. And that to me is, I hadn't realized what a radical idea that was. So a guy who read my book, who used to be a columnist for the Financial Times, said, this is a radical idea. And I said this yesterday to an international finance Zoom event I was doing. I said, make the other person look good. That's not radical, is it? And somebody said, yeah, it is. And I thought that's what leadership was.
Right.
I thought being a leader is about making the team look good. But maybe I'm too naive.
Well, it's just, I think we, I think for many of us, because we're close in age, I think we got seduced by the sort of Jack Welch GE era, where it was like, and of course, all of that fell apart. All of that, and everyone who worked for Welch who went to these other companies, just reading about this at Home Depot, one of Nardelli who went to Home Depot, just, yeah, profits, they sort of went up right away because you cut the labor force. And then, of course, 7 years later, you've got nothing but problems because, of course, it was not human-centered in any way and still are, and this is an important part that you bring up early in the book, and you say two specters are hanging over us, remote and robots. But also what you talk about is that this is not so much about the future of work, but I think you talk about to have a future at work. So let's talk about that a little bit of where we sit right now with work as it is and work as it's going to become, and why improvisation then becomes really what I think you and I both think is an essential skill.
Yeah. I guess in my head, I was thinking of my daughter who's 18, and I was thinking of the many middle managers I meet who are looking for a promotion and they don't get it because something called people skills. Also looking to what are the jobs going to be. So the book is addressed to the individual. And somebody else said to me the other day, it's really encouraging. And I said, I'm glad you use that word because I want everyone to think whatever their state of life is, I can learn something from this. And whatever it is I think I couldn't do, maybe I could give it a shot. It's even okay to make mistakes, but try stuff out, your leadership style. Try talking to somebody you didn't talk to. Try being looser in certain events or in an agenda, be harder, have a side meeting, try stuff out. To me, it's fascinating because remote is not going away. I mean, it's wonderful that I can speak to you on Zoom.
Yeah.
Isn't it great? And we're not using carbon. Well, not too much carbon, not as much carbon as if I had to fly. On the other hand, robots, and I'm fascinated by this, with ChatGPT, which has sort of happened since I finished the book, which in some respects, is it going to take knowledge workers' jobs? I don't know. We all thought that artificial intelligence would sort of take a certain echelon. I don't know which jobs it's going to take, but I feel it's going to add a whole bunch of new jobs. If we manage it well, and of course, there is a dark specter of what AI is doing when people who know are resigning and saying, this is, you know, I wish we hadn't done what we did to lead where we are. Remote to me is the future. Hybrid in some respects. And Paul Zak the other day was saying, we need to get together, we need to be in the office. Because of that, something that happens when we're social. But I'm saying, yes, when you are in the office, don't just say we're in the office. Make that really as human as possible. Mm-hmm. Intentional. We're here. And so let's use it. Let's collaborate. Let's be together. Okay. Let's have lunch, even if that's all we do. But how can we bring that social element to Zoom, to Teams, and so forth? And to me, improv is the absolute answer. Listen. Listen to what somebody said. Bring people in. Let disparate voices be heard. Be playful. You know, when I run a Zoom session, people can't quite believe how I do it because I treat it like an improv show.
Right.
So I stand up and I look inside people's lives and what's behind you? What's going on there? Is it a guitar? Is it a this? And I use what's in their life as an offer. And of course, it becomes part of the game. And again, March 16th, 2020, my world fell apart. I don't know if you remember, it was when we hadn't quite closed down the UK, but the Prime Minister said, nobody go out to restaurants or cafes without kind of making it a legal requirement. So my keynotes, my coaching, my workshops, the comedy store, shut. And so I thought, what am I going to do? And so somebody said, try Zoom. And breakouts, so we can do like we did in workshops where people go play on their own without being looked at by everybody, which is what I like in workshops. Two or three people play, then they report back saying, well, she listened to me. And actually, when she said that, when he did this, and it was the joy of improv, of the joy of not knowing, but also saying, well, I wanted it to go this way. And I'm saying, really? In just a silly little game like this, you had an agenda. What's it like at work for you? So anyway, to me, the improv skills and drills, yes, and accept, build, follow the follower. All of our precepts are totally adaptable and necessary to make Zoom humane. No less kind of have a proper agenda. So it doesn't just, you know, the worst Zoom calls I had, by the way, were with the other Comedy Store players because there was nobody running it. We were just exactly. There was nobody running it. We are an anarcho-syndicalist collective who for 38 years have had no structure, no bank account. And that's why it's worked, because there has been no leadership in some respects, but we only play together a couple of hours a week. But our Zoom meetings were a mess because there was no agenda. There was nobody leading it. And so I say, you know, do have an agenda, like you have a running order with a, with an improv show, or you have a structure with a narrative long form. But within that, then we have the joy of the spontaneity, but the practice that improv has, which is I'm consciously, intentionally listening to what you're saying and using your contribution to move forward.
Another thing I wanted to talk to you about is I often have to describe the difference between improvisation and comedy or humor, in part because they get conflated, just like creativity and innovation do, and they're two different things. And yes, a lot of comedy and humor comes out of improvisation, mostly because of some sort of revealed truth. But there's this other part, and there's more and more science on this right now in terms of the overall benefits to humor in the workplace, which is tricky. There's another line that I've used often, which is you got to be very careful if you're going to use comedy without a license, because there's sort of light humor and whimsy and all those things, which I think are very safe. But going that sort of extra step, what professional comedians do, is often sort of rough territory. How do you toe that line? Because I know it comes up in your workshops, because people, when they do our work, they laugh.
Yeah, well, I often get that, especially when dealing with non-UK audiences. They say, don't do jokes about the Prime Minister. I say, you don't understand. I'm not doing jokes.
No.
At no point do I do, did you hear the one about?
I don't know any jokes.
Yeah, I only know two jokes. One is absolutely filthy. And the other one is what's red and sits in the corner? A naughty strawberry.
Okay. All right.
There you go.
We know, where's the king keep his armies? Up his sleeveys.
Sleeveys, so exactly.
We know children's pun jokes.
Yes, exactly. Otherwise, I don't remember them. I don't particularly like jokes. I mean, we could talk about it for another 58 hours, but yes, philosophically, a joke is closed-ended to me, and a joke may often have a victim. Whereas for me, improv is acknowledging our shared humanity. It's right. Fragile. It's saying, I don't know what I'm going to say. You said something. I'll steal that and build on it. That to me is it. I mean, you did a TED talk, by the way, just to quote back to you, when you said your son, I think he's called Nick, where he said, isn't it fun, Dad? I did this improv class where it's okay to be nice and funny. Mm-hmm. And I think, yeah, because improv is about making the other person look good. Yes, there are moments when you tip over into something which I might call disaffiliative humor. I found this, and I use this, affiliative humor is we are in it together. Moments of sadness can be lightened by gallows humor or perspective taking. Disaffiliative is you're outside my group. Look at you. And that's not humor to me. That's bullying. And the laughter is hollow. But I know, and you know, that in workshops, when people are laughing, they're going to learn.
Yeah.
And I do have a whole section, a chapter on humor. And I try and point out that humor, the best humor is the one we all share. When the leader says, I don't know what to do, or look at what a mess I made of it, when I was young, and I came through. So ultimately, I describe to people that we're being funny. Yeah, we play at the Comedy Store. But the thing we're aiming towards is story. Both the story of this scene, but also the story of six people having fun together. And even the story of that person who made that suggestion early on and keeps making. The other day, we asked for location. Somebody said Belgium. And every sort of 10 minutes, he'd say Belgium. And right at the end, we took the curtain call and he shouted Belgium again. And that is an example of what you and I would call a callback. I call it reincorporation because that's the word Mike Myers taught me, reincorporate. I used to say recycle, which is bring back a thing from before. recognition. I understand your wife has got a three-tier thing: pain, distance, and recognition.
Yeah,
and and for me, the which a lot of people I notice they notice I use on the stage is the reincorporation. That character, that bit, that word comes back in a new environment, and it's just pleasing. We don't know why. I think it's to do with narrative, which is that's some story. The story that weaving threads. Of what happened before, and we see him again, we see her again in this new environment. So for me, the easiest humor is reincorporating what somebody said to me earlier. Or they say they came from Putney in London, and then 10 minutes later I say, what's it like in Putney? I haven't said anything funny. I hope I haven't said you're rubbish because you're from Putney, but I've just gently said what you said matters to me. And it's my favorite form, really, is just bringing back stuff. It's just throwing it in again, the callback, the tiny moment that says, hey, I remember what you said and what matters to you. And I have to be honest with you, I use humor in the workshops to tease out the truth, I hope. And when somebody, we do a one word at a time game and somebody says two words or three words, I say, that's perfect. You're such a good leader. You deserve to say three times more than anybody else. and you know, I'm playing with it.
Yeah.
And then I say, well, control. We're playing a game where you can't be in control.
Yeah.
Other than of your one word. And how do you find that? Is that frustrating? And I play games where we do a one word at a time. And I say, somebody step out. You're not in the gang anymore, but you can direct. And how do you like that? And sometimes people say it's great because somebody with an outside ear, like in music, the conductor or the leader of the jazz group, was able to listen to the whole. Some people say, I didn't want to be outside. I don't want to be in the gang playing. It was more fun to be on the dance floor rather than being on the balcony, to use
a
metaphor. Yeah.
There's a scientist by the name of Nick Chatter who I've had on the podcast twice. The second one hasn't aired yet. His first book was talking about improvisation and consciousness, and sort of, you know, his theory was that there isn't some sort of like deep dark well that we're going to. There are all of our experiences, all of our ideas, and we just draw on them at different times, you know, and whether we have access, we might have access, we might not, we might forget that they're there, those sort of things. His latest book, which he co-wrote with Morten Christensen, is called The Language Game. And his theory is that language is improvised. That rather than, if you look at Chomsky, Pinker, some of the other thinkers, they all have this sort of like thinking that language was some sort of like granite, big marble granite thing inside all of us that we just sort of chip away with and get to. And like, no, it isn't. There wouldn't be 800 different languages if that was the case. What there are kids playing games with words, objects, ideas, their bodies, their mouths, their eyes, all those things. And they just practice it and practice it. And people who are maybe less good at language don't get as much practice. And it's kind of a radical idea. And one that I think is again, speaks to what you and I are talking about, both in terms of improvisation, but also this recognition piece. Because what they point out in this the book on language is that also our conversations are often like charades. If you were to, I will look at the manuscript later for our conversation because I have to do like what we call rule of three for our website where I pull out stuff. I never use the actual words in their entirety because they won't make sense. But anyone listening to our conversation will not think that. They will think, no, this makes perfect sense. What do you mean?
Yes, I love that. A friend of mine is a professor of linguistics and he listens out for disfluences and how many there are where I start a sentence having rejigged what I was going to say. And we don't mind. In fact, we are hearing that and thinking the same ourselves. Oh, right, we'll go with that. And so you couldn't write that down. Mm-mm. And in a way to perhaps extend your thought, I always say to people, improv, and I call it improv, so as to define this form of theatre, which is different from scripted theatre. I say, if you asked us to write that down and recreate it, it would be mad. I mean, it's hard enough, and I find this with audience members, when they say, I tried to explain on the Monday morning what I saw the night before. And I say, yeah, it's the original. You had to be there. Mm-hmm. It only works if you've sat through the 2 hours of the reincorporation, the callback, that person teasing that person, somebody saying Belgium, the chicken is the bank robber, whatever. And it's just, it's rubbish.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It's a stream of consciousness which we are sharing. And again, the audience in an improv show is on the edge of their seat because we're going to fall over at any time. We drop the balls. But they know it's for them. It's unique. And they're invested. When they watch stand-up or script, they're sitting, well, I know they've done it before. They'll do it another time. Do I like it? Well, maybe. Maybe there'll be another stand-up in a minute. I like her more than this one. And it's a very different experience. And I used to say it's kind of eating a burger versus steak. And I'm not sure if, even if we are eating less meat now, whether it's the right metaphor. But it's a different kind of meal for sure. Mm-hmm. It's tiring. People say to me, I'm exhausted. My tummy's aching. My cheeks are aching. And I'm saying, yeah. If Freud says that pleasure is the relief of pain, there's quite a lot of pain watching improv because you can see us teetering on the verge of failure, which makes it so immersive, if
yeah.
I may say.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But you're right. If you've got to read this nonsense that we're saying, but if you're there, even listening to it later, people say I get where they were. There was a sort of growing thing and they meandered and stuff like that. You couldn't make an article of this, but I think
what people, why podcasts are so popular right now and radio previously, because it's just another version of radio, is because people are responding to what they recognize, which is how we all communicate. Yeah. And it's why David Mamet, who was a busboy at Second City in the 60s, you know, for a long while was such a celebrated playwright because it was the first time we were hearing language that was what he called naturalistic dialogue, which he picked up by watching people improvise because for the most part, especially American improvisation, we're in Chicago, we're not playing a lot of characters, or the characters are very close to ourselves. So it is how regular human beings speak.
Yeah. Well, as I say to people, any organization, you think there's a logo, you think there's a building, but actually it's just a bunch of people having improvised conversations.
Yeah, that's right.
With their suppliers, with their customers. And how can you define that? We do want to make it objective, and you know, we have a brand and stuff like that, but ultimately I found this quote which I saw Henry Mintzberg speak once, and I can't find where he said it anywhere else. He said management is conversations interrupted. And that to me, and it's brilliant, isn't it? Because you know, that's what families are, that's what friends are. It's kind of just a bunch of conversations. And we never quite get to the answer. And many improv scenes kind of, we say, and scene, because we got a big laugh. Even better, occasionally we win the treasure, the dragon is defeated, the prince and princess are together. That doesn't always happen. So we say scene. Sometimes we say scene just a bit too late, or we say just as the thing was about to get to it. So that endings, I would say, often is an offer in improv. But when you try and explain to people that we're improvising all the time, wouldn't you like to get better at it from people who do it professionally? That has a bit of traction. Other people say, I'm so terrified of having to do a workshop with you because I don't know what to say. And I say, well, what do you do on a Tuesday morning? That you say stuff that you kind of thought before, but maybe you're saying in different ways. Mm-hmm. And actually, when you say to people, like the first game I often do is just they sit there quietly while I guide them on a guided visualization. They walk along a road in their head. And I say, you've improvised. You've taken an offer from me of it's by the seaside. It's in the city. It's last year. It could be when you're a child. And you've enacted it without moving an improvised scene. So it's a mixture of pre-thought, you know, ideas, images, and what's occurred to you in the moment. And they often say, I don't know why it came into my head. And I say, at the end of the game, there's a gift waiting for you. And people will say, gosh, I didn't know where that came from. And I say, that's the place that's interesting to me, that I didn't know where it came from. Mm-hmm. And allow yourself to be there sometimes. Know that you're more comfortable sometimes being, I know where stuff is going to come from. I've got a plan. I've got a to-do list. but your brain wants a bit of both and needs to know where it is.
Yeah. Okay, in a moment I'm going to ask you for a yes hand story, but you talk about storytelling in the book. So I want to sort of tell you my journey with storytelling. So when I wrote the book Yes And, I was really brought in as a writer because I write, and I produced at Second City for decades at that point. I didn't do the corporate stuff. I occasionally got brought in to ideate on things, whatever. So it was a kind of a journey of discovery in terms of like, oh, how do we apply this here? How do we apply that here? What are some client stories my partner Tom would bring in, and I would sort of craft them up and then talk about the work as I knew it. And then, of course, the book comes out and people want you to go speak about the book. So I start doing more and more of these keynotes. And sometimes I'm not a teacher. I can lead people through a few exercises, but I'm married to the teacher. I'm not a teacher. And what I saw on our website is that we get brought in for storytelling a lot. And at that point, and this is a few years back, we really weren't teaching improvisation so much as related to storytelling. We had really smart improv people looking at Joseph Campbell and some other theories around that. And it started to frustrate me personally that, like, wait, I think there's a more of a symbiotic relationship here between storytelling and the improv work. It doesn't need to be, alien from that. But I couldn't grasp it, in part because the clients didn't know what they wanted. They would say, this is the thing I know, which is like, we want something storytelling. And I'm like, do you? Okay, so we start going down the list. Do you mean sales? Do you mean pitching? Do you mean leadership? Do you? So what it would become would be, first, it was getting an idea of what they were actually looking for. And then for me, and this has ever evolved, I'm still evolving, but I'm almost there, is then what aspects of the storytelling process as it relates to improv are important. And I know what it is in leadership, right? And because I think it's pretty apparent, especially in our need for our leaders to be good communicators, show empathy and vulnerability, and that magic word everyone talks about, authenticity, which is way more... It's not ethereal. And I think one of the mistakes most people writing about authenticity have is they don't know how to approach it by anything else. And for you and I, it's like, no. This is where the good stuff is. And often what it is those flaws, those mistakes, those resilient journeys that you have had to take that are the thing that your audience, your workers are craving for. They want to know your fiascos. All right. So that's my journey of storytelling. Can you talk about how it shows up in your book?
Well, exactly the same. They say, we want storytelling. And I say, what do you want? Do you mean better presentations, clearer slides, how to marshal an argument, and which is all fine.
Sure.
Or do you want something, a story, this basic software that's been around since the dawn of humankind? Mm-hmm. And Joseph Campbell, who I was introduced to you by Mike Myers, he said, there's a shapeshifter, there's the 12 moments, there's the climax, the resurrection. And one time at London Business School, I went through all the, the 12 steps, and they just looked at me like I was mad. I got terrible reviews. And so I thought, I better not do 12. So I do three now. Beginning, middle, and end, where we started, what we did, where we ended up, variations thereon. So storytelling is a bit of a thing now, a bit like purpose. We don't know what it means, but it sounds like we ought to have some of it, or maybe more of it, actually. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I have to, as you, what do you really mean? Do you mean just better presenting, which is fine? Do you mean something more ethereal, which is understanding where we fit in the business, understanding where we're heading, making sense of what's happened. I saw Tom Peters speak once, and he said, leaders don't make decisions, they make sense. Basically, that was it.
Making, and, sure. Mm-hmm.
And another thing was, I read somewhere, it doesn't matter what decisions you make, as long as you make some, and as long as 10% are right. It was kind of that. And to me, it was, I'm often called in, and it's basically the company. We want to be able to tell the client what we're good at. Okay, so find out what else is happening, and begin to understand in a few lines how you can tell that story. Or, and this is what I find particularly with management consultants: tell me about a recent project. Right, and they don't know how to explain it. They don't know how to explain it to a normal person. And I say, and this one of my favorite games now is to explain it now in real business jargon, the most complex alignment, sustainability, KPI, ROI, leverage. Give me as many management buzzwords as you can, and then tell the same story, but just as you would to your 8-year-old niece, nephew, your neighbor you met at a barbecue. And of course, you know, we took this thing that was losing money. Now it's making money. Just things like that. And mm-hmm. there's lots of literature out there. And I mentioned one in my book about how to make a story of what just seemed like an assignment. Pixar had the Story Spine by Ken Adams that came from improv. So story can go very ethereal and highfalutin with the shapeshifter and the mentor and the inciting incident and stuff like that, all of which is helpful, I think, to writers when they rewrite their sort of unclear narrative movie theater. On the other hand, I have lately started to say to leaders, your job is a storyteller. Mm-hmm. You've got to tell us how we got here. You've got to tell us where we are, and then you've got to tell us where we're going next.
Yeah.
And that's where the improv comes in, which is listening to your clients say, and they say, we want this to happen. And then you listen and you kind of tell them the story of where they're heading. You tell them what the treasure is or the dragon that's being defeated. And this is where professional services can really make a difference, where they say, let me tell this story of why you're here, how you got here. And the client go, thanks. You understand us because you told us our story. And I got this a bit from Marshall Gantz, mm-hmm. who talks about public story, which is basically the story of me, the story of us, and the story of next, roughly, you know, which is what are my values? What am I authentic to? How do we get here? Where are we going next? And tell that as a story. Now, and that doesn't have to be long arcane moments of the protagonist and the antagonist. It needs to be, this is where we are. We're losing 50 million. And then I say, just tell me what the end. Now we've saved 50 million. Okay. Now just do a quick thing about act two. Well, we did a thing and now it's tied it up. So story is indeed very profound, but it can be overly mystified.
Yeah.
And also people don't know what they mean by it. And if I can just say to me, explain it as you would to somebody who doesn't understand the world you're in.
Yeah.
And the first step to what is metaphor. What's the analogy? You're a doctor for business. You're looking under the looking at the engine. But actually what we care about is where the car's going to go. We don't know what the map is, but we know we're going to go there together or something where. And of course, some people find that a bit hard, which is, well, I can only talk in terms of the thing I do. So that's where storytelling has, for me, has come about, is better explaining what we did, who we are. And then I challenge people to say, you may have a few stories about your company. Can you rewrite the same story where your client becomes the protagonist? Because you were the Obi-Wan Kenobi, they're Luke Skywalker. And then eventually make the hero, the protagonist, the heroine, the customer, the person who doesn't know what's going on with the bonnet, but just knows their life is easier now. And then you tell the same story about the project, but from the end user. And even sometimes, and in this country, there was the hero was the COVID app, for example. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we didn't know how it worked. We knew a bunch of people worked on it, but it was the hero of the story. And I say, wouldn't that be great to make the project, the device, the software, the product, the hero, the heroine who saw us out of the darkness into the light. And that's about as far as I let myself go with sort of story philosophy.
It's interesting. As you were talking, this thing was flashing on me that I don't think I've articulated for myself yet. So this will be the first time. But I think because we, again, I look at our website in terms of what we offer, and there's always, it's like, these are just words. And I, you know, when I talk about them, they might make sense, but just looking at them. And probably the biggest thing we sell is a thing called communication skills. And I think the difference here is that communication training outside of what we do is scripted almost entirely. And yet communication is 99% unscripted. And so the radical idea here is the idea of playful communication being thoroughly unique to anyone who is entering this if they haven't done improv before.
Yeah, well, this is, people often think I teach improv on stage, therefore I'm teaching presentation skills. Yeah. And when I started, I didn't want to be a presentation coach, but I've become that sometimes. And I want people to be clear, when you've got a presentation that's supposed to last 5 minutes, make sure it lasts 4 minutes 50. Make sure you're rehearsed. Make sure you know where your slides are. I even, things like if it's in front of a big audience, make sure we're going to put the pack, the microphone pack, the battery stuff. It's heavy. If you're a woman, you don't have anywhere to put it. Might have to end up down your bra. So wear a jacket or ask for a pouch or something like that. Just boring stuff like that. So I think when it's a presentation or something scripted, really work hard. Rehearse it. Use all of the software infrastructure we would for a play. Try stuff out, rewrite, have somebody in with the room with you to kind of say, slow down, speed up, all that makes sense. But you're right. And I'm not even sure 99%, who knows how much is improvised. A lot of it is, but certainly the medium of understanding between colleagues is mostly improvised conversation. Mm-hmm. Selling can be scripted and,
To a degree.
But then, you know, there's the follow-up conversation, whatever that is. But, you know, I've read the PDF. I've seen the website. I like the advert or whatever. That's the script. Then I need to know a little bit about, well, will it fit my life?
Yeah.
But you're right. And as I often sort of think, they're asking me in to help with improv. And do they really know where it's leading? Because it may lead to changes in how they perceive the infrastructure, which your person, what she called Zen Tone.
Zainab Tone.
Zainab Tone. Okay. Yeah, so, well, I have to write that down. But again, this continual dynamic between structure, which enhances, and structure, which is destructive. And the same structure may be helpful to begin with, and then a year later isn't. Communication skills to me, yes, presentation. And I try and say sometimes, you know, formal and informal, how I present myself, my personal impact. And that, of course, is how I'm in when I'm my improvised self, if you like.
Hmm. All right. We always end the podcast, and usually I have to explain the concept of yes and I don't. you have a yes and story for us.
I do. 10 years into the Comedy Store Players, we had our celebration. There was some PR and yada yada, and I was getting tired, and I was feeling bad.
Hmm.
I spent Sunday and Wednesday evenings improvising 2 hours, you know, and half an hour to get there and back, whatever. I've wasted my time. I'm thinking, look at all these clever people who spent the equivalent time writing scripts and getting on well, and their work now lives beyond them. It's a book. It's a TV show. It's a movie. And I thought, I've made a mess. I should have spent that time doing something that lived beyond me, beyond the moment of the stage, of the Comedy Store. It was lost. That improv moment disappeared into the ether. I took 3 months off, and I said to the other Comedy Store Players, I'm having 3 months off. In fact, I said I'm going to leave, but Paul Merton, who's quite a famous guy here, said, no, don't leave, just take 3 months off. And I said, and I'd also done a lot of the admin, making sure we had enough players that night, etc. So I said, I'm not going to do that. 3 months, you've got to fend for yourselves. Within a month and a half, I was saying, are there any slots available, please? And the yes was, yes, I have done improv. The but was, but I should have been doing script. The and was, I've done it. So what am I telling myself? And actually, the "and" was, "and you should be doing more improv." And that's what led me to teaching it. So 95 was when I had that moment. By 98, I was actively teaching improv to actors at the Actors Center and other places. And by 98, I was thinking, this is where I can really add some value to people outside performers. These skills on stage work beautifully. Couldn't they help off stage? And that was my "and." It was not, "you haven't done, you should have been writing instead. You wasted time improv. You haven't done enough improv. You should be doing more." That's the thing. Look at the offer in your own life of, you've spent all this time doing improv. What's the "and"? The "and" is, take that beyond the stage.
I love it. The book is called In the Moment: Build Your Confidence, Communication, and Creativity at Work. Neil Mullarkey, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Survive.